This is Fresh Air. Director George Cukor left us with many great films. A Star is Born, The Philadelphia Story, Born Yesterday, Dinner at Eight, Gaslight, and Camille. And who can forget the death scene from Camille?
Nanine, get the doctor quickly.
Doctor, if you can't make me live, how can he?
No, no. Don't say such things, Marguerite. You live. You must live.
Perhaps it's better if I live in your heart, where the world can't see me. If I'm dead, there'll be no stain on our love.
Oh, my guest Patrick McGilligan has written a new biography of George Cukor called A Double Life. Cukor was forced to live a double life because he was a homosexual. Although many of his colleagues knew this, he had to live his life in the closet. Cukor made movies from the 1930s to the early 80s, but even today, many gay actors and directors don't think it's safe yet to step out of the closet. In researching this book, McGilligan asked Cukor's friends and colleagues who had always protected his identity to now be as open as possible. Many were understandably reluctant and tried to feel McGilligan out.
They were very interested in to what extent I was going to explore his sexuality, and I think that I compromised with their point of view, or at least I tried to compromise with their point of view being a more let's say of the old school, a more tactful, more discreet point of view, and my point of view being one that I would like to know as much as possible. I remember one of the first people that I went to go see that I was introduced to, he asked me very point blank, he said, "You're not going to reveal what goes on behind the bedroom doors, are you?" And I said to him honestly that he would have to tell me what went on behind the bedroom doors before I could tell him whether or not that was important to the book I was writing. I wasn't sure at that point. So I talked to them honestly, and they, I think, spoke to me honestly, and we achieved, I think, a compromise in our positions. And some of them were very courageous to talk to me because they were talking about things that they don't talk about publicly, generally speaking.
Cukor was always called a great women's director, and he was said to have a great gift for directing women. Was women's director code for homosexual?
I think I discovered when I researched his life and career further back that beginning on Broadway and in his summer stock years in Rochester, that he had a reputation as a women's director. So that started before he came to Hollywood, really. And when he came to Hollywood, the publicity machine picked up on it and kind of trumpeted it to newspapers and magazines around the country. And he began to be assigned some movies that starred temperamental or difficult or sensitive actresses. And for a while, he went along with this publicity. It was really orchestrated by MGM once he became a leading director at MGM. But I think in the end, it was a kind of a millstone for him. It became a code word for homosexuality. It became kind of pejorative in some people's mouths. In other people's mouths, it's a great compliment.
I thought one of the most interesting stories in the book was a story about his getting fired from Gone with the Wind. Cukor was the first director of that film. It ended up getting directed by Victor Fleming. You say he was fired from the film because of Clark Gable's objections. What were Gable's objections?
Well, again, it's a long, complicated story, and there were a series of circumstances, and there had been a long pre-production, and by the time the film was getting ready to go before the cameras, Cukor was kind of tired of it all, and I think he kind of looked askance at Gone with the Wind from the very beginning. It wasn't his kind of material, didn't have much humor in it, and I think David O. Selznick had become obsessed with it, and there were a lot of problems with budget, and there were a lot of problems with script because Selznick wouldn't make up his mind about the script. And along came the casting of Clark Gable. And Gable and Cukor actually had this curious connection in that one of Cukor's very good friends, William Haynes, who had been a silent screen star and later an interior decorator for many famous people and many people in Hollywood, had a sexual encounter in the late 1920s, Gable and Haynes. And this was well known in this particular circle. And Gable was made very nervous by Cukor directing him. I don't think Cukor helped matters when he insisted that Gable work on a Southern accent And Gable eventually put his foot down and would work no further on a Southern accent. And there was all kinds of talk around the office about all kinds of worry that Cukor was going to throw the picture to Vivian Leigh and somehow, you know, forget Clark Gable and not give fair due to his performance. And this was the kind of atmosphere surrounding the set at the point at which one day Gable threw a tantrum and said, I will not be directed by a fairy. I must be directed by a real man. And he stormed off the set. And it shocked people, and there was just utter silence, and no one knew what to say because whatever else he was, Gable was a complete professional, and he had never done anything like that before. And it really gave David O. Selznick an excuse to shut down the production and have the script worked on, which is what really needed working on, and to fire Cukor as a scapegoat and to bring in Victor Fleming, who was a motorcycle riding buddy of Clark Gable's, and they had a lot of things in common. So it was kind of the final straw in a long series of circumstances. But Cukor, to his private circle and to his close friends, when the doors were closed, he would tell them that this was one of the reasons why he was fired, and it hurt him deeply that he was betrayed by David O. Selznick at this point. Other times later in his life, he would be often asked why he was fired. It's really one of the great mysteries, or it was considered one of the great mysteries in Hollywood lore. And he would say, "I've blanked it out. I can't really remember. It's not too important." Or he would come up with some kind of superficial excuse that no one ever felt comfortable with. And it was because he couldn't tell the real reason.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the director, George Cukor. My guest is Patrick McGilligan, author of a biography of Cukor called A Double Life. And Cukor directed many films, including Camille, Adam's Rib, Little Women, A Star is Born, The Philadelphia Story. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick McGilligan, and we're talking about George Cukor, the subject of McGilligan's new biography. I think a very interesting story that you tell is how George Cukor went to see the Charles Ludlam version of Camille. Now Cukor had directed Greta Garbo in Camille, and Charles Ludlam was a director who passed away a few years ago from AIDS, and he ran something called the Ridiculous Theater Company, in which he would star in drag in classic women's roles, and he played the role of Camille on this production that Cukor went to see. It was a wonderful production. What was Cukor's reaction to it?
Well, Cukor made a brave effort to adapt to the 60s and to the 70s. He lived much longer than a lot of his contemporaries, and he lived to see gay liberation. And he was terribly, I would say, he was afraid of gay liberation for a while, and then he was a little bit intimidated by it, and then he was a little intrigued by it. He was certainly very confused by what he saw at that production of Camille. It did not make a lot of sense to him. You were asking someone to move from one era into the next all too rapidly. And yet I think, you know, it says a lot for him that he was willing to go see it and think about it and react to it.
How did Cukor feel about being gay? Were you able to get a sense of that?
Well, I think he accepted it at a very early age, meaning as a teenager. I think he discovered his sexuality the same way anybody else did, you know, thinking about it and wondering about it and then finally trying it and deciding. But I think he felt somewhat ashamed of being homosexual. I'm not sure, that might be too strong of a word, but he was raised in a Victorian era where it was against the law in many ways to be a homosexual, and that police were always coming after homosexuals for various either implied or actual behavior that even by any standards would be considered innocent today. And I think this, and then plus the fact that he had to play this game in Hollywood so that he would have to be terribly circumspect on the set and when at work and at home was where he indulged his private life. This, I think, made him wary and to some extent ashamed, and it certainly created a psychology that was complex.
There's some odds and ends stories about some of the films that Cukor directed that I'd like for you to tell. One of his classic films is Camille, which starred Greta Garbo. It's a wonderful film. But you tell the story of how Cukor used to mimic the actors and actresses while he was behind the camera directing.
Yes. He had a lot of different ways of directing, but one of his ways of directing was to stand behind the camera and mouth the lines, and almost kind of violently mouth them so that he was almost a distraction to them. And it certainly was a distraction to Greta Garbo, who would probably have preferred to act her scenes always with nobody around except the camera. And he was, at one point, she was doing one of her very sad scenes. Of course, it's a very sad movie. And he was, you know, virtually weeping crocodile tears as he watched her, and his mouth, you know, distorted. And she banned him from the set so that she could finish off the scene. Not atypical of Garbo. And not atypical of Cukor in the sense that he was a very flamboyant character on the set and very much in charge. And that's one of the ways he did direct, was to show people how to do things, not actually to act it, but to mimic it.
Did you find out anything about how he got the mood in Camille?
Well, I write in the book that Camille happened to coincide with the death of his mother. And, of course, the climax of Camille is the death of Camille, or at least the ending of the picture. And his mother had died shortly before he was to film that scene. And so he was really shuttling between reality and motion pictures at that point, because he had, being an utter professional, he came back to work to film that scene. He liked to say that he didn't really tell Greta Garbo what to do in that scene, but he remembered how his mother had turned her head to the wall because she was suffering so greatly that she didn't want her son to see her suffer in her final hours, and that somehow he communicated this to Garbo, and she did something similar in the scene. I'm not sure it's there in the scene. I'm not sure it's there in the cut that we see in videos and on television and at revivals today. But it certainly meant that he was feeling that movie very deeply, and he was feeling that character very deeply, and that it coincided with his life at a time which is one of the reasons why it's one of his greatest films, and you can watch it today, and it stands up, and it's a beautiful film.
Now, Cukor didn't direct The Wizard of Oz, but he was a consultant on it. What does he take credit for in the film?
Well, I don't think he was much of a consultant. At MGM, you know, they would say, run over to Lot 6 and check in for a couple of days and help so-and-so who's needs help on this. Wizard of Oz had numerous directors, and at one point they called Cukor in and asked him to take a look at Judy Garland and give some advice, and she had on a blonde wig, and he threw a fit, you know, and said, take off that blonde wig. She looks like a horror. And she was adopting some kind of funny accent, and he told her to stop acting fancy schmancy and just speak like someone from Kansas. And this is just about all he did. It probably took 2 or 3 days of looking at things and then talking to her. And it's not, you hear this kind of story about Cukor over and over again, that he would give this kind of advice and that he would do a little thing that would really unlock an actress or an actor and really help them with their performance. And imagine that movie with Judy Garland in a blonde wig.
With an accent.
With any kind of accent. She was striving. She was striving to do something that she needn't stride so hard to do, and that's what he was telling her.
Now, he later directed Judy Garland in A Star is Born, which I think might be her best film, but this was a period in her life where she was having tremendous problems, terrible mood swings, drug problems, food problems, a lot of weight fluctuations during the making of the film. How did he handle that? What was his approach?
Well, he always handled it the same way. And he had run across this problem dating back to Broadway, meaning actresses who drank too much and didn't show up on time, and a temperamental, sensitive, fragile, neurotic. In Judy Garland's case, he had grown to know her, and he had grown to like her a lot and really feel admiration for her talent. And when he was offered a chance to direct A Star is Born, he leaped at it. And she was very difficult. She was suffering in many ways during the making of that film. And his reaction was always the same when he had that problem with Garbo, when he had that problem with Marilyn Monroe later on. His reaction was patience, and his reaction was nurturing, and his reaction was kindness. And if he lost his temper at a moment, it was usually strategic. But he was always the kindest of men in that regard, and he helped her through the film, and he helped her to her most compelling performance and her greatest film, certainly.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of George Cukor, A Double Life. This is Fresh Air.